Michael Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about Francis Bacon, a English, very, very English philosopher, mathematician. I would call him a proto-scientist or almost a proto-natural philosopher, existing in late Renaissance England under the reign of Elizabeth I, and I think it's James IV from Scotland came down after Elizabeth tried to unify the two things. And this is the second episode. First episode we had a brief review of his life, and after reading philosopher after philosopher, where they were either the leading light or a significant controller like Aristotle or Pythagoras or Socrates. He's a bit of a classic Renaissance man in the idea of Machiavelli trying to support his lord. He's really relevant or bound to the lords. And when you actually go through it, some of the philosophers have been bound to the lords. There's Leibniz, who is bound to a series of the Hanoverian court, and who eventually became George the First of England, the grandson. He hung around for a long time. This person is very much of someone who's trying to get patronage at various points in time. So he's got the Earl of Essex, I think it is. He advises him very much like Machiavelli advises. So there's the power group and there's a group outside it. So it's really in the time before science. Then he's a Cambridge person, but he's not a Cambridge person in, one of the things you sort of really understand is that Cambridge and Oxford were about generating, were church focused. He was, after being a short while in there, his haunts was the, what is it, it was an inn, I've actually forgotten the name of the inn. Oh, there you go, my brain is really grazing. Now, what does that mean to an Australian? You'd think an inn is like a public house. Indeed, there were public houses, and public houses were very much a place of residence. Sort of, you can imagine there wouldn't be a shopping mall to go to. The streets would be a bit muddy. You spent a lot of time in your inns. I took a bit of research after Gray's Inn. It was just plopped in there. So I should remind you, people, this is the Stanford Encyclopedia of Philosophers. Now, is this good? It is good. It's a certain level of thoroughness, but they tend to, in the Stanford Encyclopedia, take a very in-house philosopher's view, you know, for philosophers' courses, so it doesn't necessarily marry up with the wants and needs of scientists and mathematicians looking at this. So you go through all of Leibniz and reading here, and some cursory, maybe one or two lines about his calculus, almost no lines about his Leibniz developments of of binary or digital arithmetic, and the links, the mathematical links. That's very much, there's almost a separate mathematical theology, and similarly here, it looks as though there's not going to be very much emphasis on Bacon and his scientific method and various things. There are things here which do which look as though they're going to be good. That's getting into Bacon's idols, idolatry of the theatre and all that type of stuff. And we get back to Gray's Inn. So I was just trying to, there's four inns and in London, and each of them had a harvest area of London, so an area like a football team has an area, and there the most equivalent I could say is a modern legal college where you do articles. So you're there. And sort of these are very big institutions. They're not universities. They don't exist nowadays. But they had a big library, and the influential people who were going to be ambassadors, lawyers, things which were not necessarily taught at the universities, learnt their trade there, and they got called up to the law, to the bar. So they're sort of a quasi-legal storage house. I was trying to think, Larry Cousins, there's a few places which provide a service to provide sort of practical training and certification, which wasn't provided by the universities at this time. So it's a very complex thing to come across, and it's quite surprising for me to come across the idea of these inns. And so these inns are quite large buildings. There's sections, entire sections of London. I can imagine one or two city blocks. They've got gardens, libraries, they've got walkways, they've got, I think dormitories, but they've also got houses, the barristers' offices, and very much the inns come up with these sort of para university areas. We have teaching hospitals. It's sort of like a teaching barristers thing that form a group, some sort of organisation. So you have a company at the moment which has a legal company has a structure a bit like an inn. It's a bit crazy to try and understand it. And so, and of course these inns serviced the lords who serviced the queen. And also reading about here, the queen is absolutely rock solid mad. She wants money and she doesn't get it. She takes people's heads off, and in order to take people's heads off, she has people either with him or against him. So it's really quite a sleazy time of British history. There is a nominal rule of law, and there's a nominal way of things, but it's really internal power. Almost similar type of thing was running in Italy at the time with the Renaissance lords. It really is high Renaissance, and so this is a great celebration of the art, the great productivity, but it's not necessarily the most rigorous of times. Also very interesting, there's a mention that in Gray's Inn was frequented by Shakespeare, and Shakespeare, I think this is again going off the memory, may have staged a play there called Much Ado About Nothing, whatever it is. And so one's understanding of Shakespeare, of Bacon, and of all these different people, they're not we have a modern idea of, say, like Shakespeare as a playwright, but other people reformulate him as a property manager, a profiteer, and someone in the business, very much a business of theatre. So he produced the plays. We now have the plays differently, so we have the producers and the directors. He was a producer and financier and profiteer, involved in a whole lot of things. So perhaps just Andrew Lloyd Webber, so Bernstein, the various people who are sort of a bit once removed but in the industry, but Shakespeare's a lot more controlled, a lot more lines in, a lot more fuzzy. And similarly, Bacon is a lot more fuzzy at this stage. He's got a political career, a legal career, dabbling in all different things, and there's no defined structure as we have in society today, where we have research institutes and political institutes and military institutes. It was a lot more fluid there, and there may be a law. Just remember, there's no companies or anything like that. You can't be a company man because there's simply no company. Companies haven't been invented yet. But you owe allegiance to your Lord and produce things forward. Now, bear in mind, Descartes, who comes a bit after, is a soldier. He was, well, now what happened to him? I sort of remember that he was in various garrison duties and a big fat oaf picked him up and injured him, so he had to retire from there. But you get all these complex stories which don't apply to scientists nowadays, like, say, Enrico Fermi or Einstein. That they come up and live their entire life as a scientist and work within that well-developed framework. The framework isn't there. So going back, there's that graze in, and a majority of people wouldn't not know the in system. They'd know Oxford, Cambridge and the universities, and they'd make an assumption pretty much so that the university was like evolved, but they wouldn't think that the universities just didn't do various things and there was a completely different branch focus. Like it's sort of similar to the banks in my view. So back in the day there were building societies, or there tend to be a lot more building societies, friendly societies, financial institutions which catered to various things, and as the banks grew they bought these people up, still had the front door, and eventually they'd remove the sign of the building society and say this is a branch of the big bank. So universities have expanded, the careers have solidified, there's no correspondence to it, and I think for a lot of the time, the vast majority of people in the Renaissance got caught up and couldn't think their way through. They were caught up with basically advanced views with ancient philosophy. So they had the ancient philosophy of Aristotle, which is Aristotle that said, I'll solve a problem, I'll develop a new product for you, and people say, well, where's your labs? Where's your experimental proof? There's none. I'm just a very, very clever person, very persuasive person, and I can use rhetoric to explain things. So rhetoric is where you have an argument, and we'll go through and listen to this. And essentially, one view is that the Roman Empire essentially moved away from scientific basis and relied increasingly on sleaze, politics and rhetoric to get its way. It's sort of like, I suppose nowadays, the spin of politicians, but the rhetoric and people, and I do believe that there will be a rise in mathematics. Science will come and save us all from all these politicians. And now we're on to episode 2. 13 minutes in, you've listened to me ramble at the start, and this is the second section called Natural Philosophy, the Struggle with Tradition. So we just heard about how Bacon had an amazingly complex political life, backing people and his lords getting executed and him having to be kicked out of Parliament. And take corruption as a corruption card to be a fall guy to support various people. And then in the last years of his life, he worked on his philosophy, his five fantastic years. And as he says, similar to our Australian heroes, I think, neutrality, he said, Nick Kelly, our famous Aussie bush ranger, who was going around in a tin can, no one could kill him because he's wearing a suit of armour. He said, such is life, but Francis Bacon says, life is brief and work is very long. You've got a lot of work to do in a very brief life. So, Bacon's here, and he's in this madcap, sleazy, sly world with spies and people you don't know to trust. And I must admit that the reading a bit of the Japanese pre-World War II history, they were all spies and samurais and spies, allegiance to lords. It's sort of like a tribal, sort of like a very primitive tribal world. Like the Renaissance is really tribal with flourishes and hoses, you know, wearing stockings, etc. So let's read this. I'm sure you're bored of me speaking at this point in time. Bacon's struggle to overcome intellectual blockades and the dramatic slumber of his age and the earlier periods had to be fought on many fronts. And really, that sums it up. It is a dogmatic slumber. People believe something and that's it. And dare I say, I think there's a dogmatic slumber at the moment in the area of education. You know, the people think, you know, teaching what they were taught is good enough, and they just fall asleep when you try to talk to them. Very early on, he criticized not only Plato, Aristotle, and the Aristotelians, but the humanists, the Renaissance scholars, as Paracelsus and Bernardino Taliso. Obviously, these are getting pretty vague. They're people who didn't win. It's sort of like in this way. I'm sure, I don't know if you're in America, you had Tab. You know, these are the soft drink that didn't survive, and only people you can't refer to it because it's out of common memory, these guys. But again, scholasticism, which is where you read the books and you get a big book out of the library, and it is, you open the first page, this is certified correct by God. Oh, okay. Read through it, got that one. And you've got a second book, read from the Bible, line by line. This is certified by God. These two books don't add up, but they're certified by God, and God is correct, so therefore I'm stupid, therefore you're off, you know, down these rabbit holes trying to work out what's going on, with no experiments going on. So, and this is Galileo. Is Galileo around the same time? Is working, doing, people beginning to do experiments and letting nature be a witness, having a disinterest in the experimental result. So this is a double-blind test. And going forward, although Aristotle provided very specific axioms for every scientific discipline, what Bacon found lacking in the Greek philosopher's work was a master principle of the general theory of science, which could be applied to all branches of natural history and philosophy. Spot on, mate. That's what you have to say. Aristotle, when you read it, it's quite dense work. There's no overstructure for it. For Bacon, Aristotle's cosmology, as well as his theory of science, had become obsolete, and consequently so, too, had many of the medieval thinkers who followed his lead. Basically, Aristotle was the New South Wales curriculum of its day. He does not repudiate Aristotle completely, so he doesn't say, "You're complete rubbish, Aristotle, go home." But he opposes the humanistic interpretation of him, which I would say is probably putting him on a pedestal, saying Aristotle, God, he's not God, but he's equivalent to God. You know how we're treating God? You treat Aristotle as God. You don't really question him. With his emphasis on syllogism and dialectics. So syllogism, a syllogism is a way of having a toolkit of knowledge and then apply it to a new situation. Sort of, I don't know. We do use syllogisms all the time. So the classic one is, all men are mortal. This, I don't know why, who came up with this one. All men will die eventually. Socrates is a man, so Socrates will die. and we do apply this in practical ways. All cars require petrol. My car doesn't work. It requires petrol. You know, it's like the standard way that we think. There's nothing special about it, but it's not necessarily a methodical way of thinking, because your car could have been broken down a different way, or you may not have a car, or it may not be a car. There's all these things, and why it requires petrol is it requires the petrol to provide the energy to explode, and go all these terms. And dialectic is basically that i.e. extending your logical thought. So it's not like Sherlock Holmes. It's like the other dudes, the other detectives who are operating around Sherlock Holmes, who don't use scientific evidence. He's from a criminal family. I have to get so many convictions a week. I therefore arrest that particular person, that type of stuff. Now, in brackets, scientia, breeder versus textual hermeneutics. I'll spell that word for you. So science is the working of science versus that sort of Renaissance things. Textual hermeneutics. HERMENEUTICS. So really, that's really people who go to Bible. I don't want to offend people, but that's people who go to Bible study. What are you doing? Are you taking any measurements? Are you launching satellites? Are you taking rock samples? Are you putting things under electron microscopes? No, I've got a Bible. I'm going in a car. I'm going to another group of people who've also got Bibles, and we're going to work it out that way. That's really what hermeneutics. And if you want to research on the net, you'll find references. It's basically Bible studies. HERMENEUTICS. And the metaphysical treatment of natural philosophy in the favour of natural forms, or nature's effect as structured in modes of actions and not artifacts. I don't quite understand that, but it's perhaps on the thrust of what this person's saying is you don't get involved in science at a high level as theories and laws, and therefore, you know, I think we have a risk of it now. He fell because of the law of gravity. It's sort of like that's all upset. It's like that's completely, completely stupid to say, because a law of gravity is an observed, consistent behaviour. Is a law. Yeah. If it always happens that way, you can say it's a law. It's a way of saying that this is a well-established behaviour that I expect to see. It's a law. But therefore, because it's not the actual reason that falls. and now structured modes of action, I suppose this is the actual physics. The stages of which correspond in shape of a pyramid of knowledge to the structural order of nature itself. What an intense stuff. So I expect that you would, the pyramid that I understand is perhaps you'd have maths and physics, leading to chemistry, leading to biology, leading all the way up to DNA and biology. That's what we have a pyramid of knowledge nowadays, based on the basic theories, but I don't think there was necessarily an idea of a pyramid of knowledge in the Renaissance. If any modern Aristotelians came near to Bacon, it was the Venetian or Paduan branch, represented by Jacopo Zabrella. Well, he's famous. On the other hand, Bacon criticised Telesco. So I'm going to have to look up you, mate. Bernardo Telesco, who, in his view, had only halfway succeeded in overcoming Aristotle's deficiencies. Well, yeah, I think what's it, Russell's logic, you know, Russell's logic, this is Bertrand Russell, who basically is computer logic, writing of logic there. If you write it out, I think it's fairly straightforward. It's like if you It's using Aristotle to fight Aristotle where you get all bundled up. Although we find the debate with Telso in an unpublished text in the middle, his middle period. Okay, so it's, quote, on the origins according to the fables of Cupid and Colum, whatever that is. Bacon began to struggle with tradition as early as 1603. I can't remember when he was born. He died in 1626. So he's a pretty old chap. And he's only got about 20 years of productive life. Where he repudiates any mixture of natural philosophy and divinity. He provides an outline of his new method, which determines that at the end of knowledge was a discovery of all operations and possibilities of operations from immortality, if that was necessary. So, the meanest mechanical practice. So, discover how everything works. So, not just work out how it works, not actually get involved in how it works and have one description meaning that it's a hierarchy. So that the best thing is that science could explain why God is immortal, and it can also explain why you cut your Renaissance steak with a knife, with a machine. So the meanest of mechanical practice. What, this is heavy going. This is sort of like Shakespeare and science added together. That's really horrid. He opposes the Aristotelian anticipo natural, which favored inquiry of causes to satisfy the mind instead of those, as will direct him to give him light to new experiences and inventions. Which is, I think basically that's what Aristotle does. So Aristotle has the four causes. And the first cause is perhaps matter, the next cause is the volume, the cause after that is what it wants to do, and finally what you want to do. You know, what are those causes there? Well, that's just a complete package such that you can win any argument. But it doesn't actually say how you would want to modify something, which is quite true. So I sort of understand it. Having looked at Aristotle, it's extremely frustrating. And, surprisingly, a lot of people use Aristotle in their day-to-day life, in the way they operate things. They, Aristotle moves very well with the concept of property. I own it. How has that brick changed? Because I own it rather than you own it. It's still very much a brick. There's all that social order. So you really need the Aristotelian viewpoint to actually drive, and this is my view, to drive a lot of social order. But in order to create the new brick, and so you're paying less, you need the scientific aspect. So I don't think, as far as this view is dead, that you can dismiss one or the other. You just have to recognise that the Aristotelian view, which is causes and whys and wants, and you can see it very much in children's books, we show the happy little engine, inanimate objects want to do things, and there's a story about it. It's very much Aristotelian, is sort of humanistic in terms of it brings forward the narrative of what you're talking about to across. There you go. I am actually quite tight at the moment, so I'm just rambling a little bit. When Bacon introduces his new systematic structure of disciplines in the advancement of learning, okay, so this is a logical way of doing it rather than just saying, here's a book on biology, here's a book on geology, here's a book on owls, here's a book on maths, here's a book on, he really wrote books on weather, Aristotle wrote it on everything. There's no reason why he did it, it was just that when someone came up and said, do you have a book on, and he would write a book on it, with very authoritative stuff, and people said, blood oath, mate, is that Aristotle? Sure thing, never questioned it. But again, there's no real structure to it. But here's Bacon, and this is why it's so fantastic. You see, he's beginning to bring the structure of science to which other people automatically filled. The advancement of learning in 1605, he continues to struggle with the tradition, primarily with the classical and Greek, rejecting the book Learning of the Humanists on the grounds that they hunt more after words than matter. Spot on, Bacon. Accordingly, he criticizes the Cambridge University curriculum for placing too much emphasis on dialectical and sophistical training, that is, the knowledge of the theory of knowledge and the theory of philosophers, asked of, quote, empty minds and unfraught with matter. That's exactly right. So I couldn't agree. The more people I find get in the way, have an empty mind, that they have a parity of reason, to quote Descartes, and their minds empty and unfraught with matter. Absolutely. He reformulates and functionally transforms Aristotle's conception of science as knowledge of necessary causes. That is, smoke rises because it wants to get to the sky. You know, truly, that's what they... And when people built hot air balloons, they put smoke in it because smoke goes up. There you go. But of course, to make the smoke, they made steam, and steam has a lower pressure before it condenses. He rejects Aristotle's logic, which is based on metaphysical theory, whereby false doctrine is implied that the experience which comes to us by means of our senses, things as appear, automatically represents to our understanding of things as they are. So something is the sum total of your senses of it. Which is something that Leibniz went along, didn't he? Simultaneously, Aristotle favours the application of general and abstract conceptual distinctions, which do not conform to things as they exist. Bacon, however, introduces his new conception of the philosophical primum. This is a meta level for all scientific disciplines. So, really, of course, I'm a scientist, I'm reading it, I have to teach science. How you can get Bacon for the kiddies, I don't know. So at this stage I sort of understand, but I couldn't translate this to something that's remotely interesting to kids. Oh god, I'm being attacked by parrots, there's parrots again. From 1606 to 1612, Bacon pursued his work on natural philosophy. Okay, he's only 20, I've got the countdown, I think it's 26 when he dies, so. Bacon pursued his work on natural philosophy, still under the auspices of a struggle with tradition. This tendency is amplified by unpublished tracts of Temporis Paris Masculus. Well, Masculus means masculine, Temporis means life, Paris means father. Cognita et Visa, the way of knowledge, Regardito Philosophian, and De Principis Anti Originibus, whatever they mean. Bacon rediscovers prehistoric philosophers for himself, especially the atomists, and among them Democritus as a leading figure. Go atoms! This is incredible. So Bacon rediscovers the atom. He gives preference to Democritus' natural philosophy in contrast with the scholastic and thus Aristotelian focus on deductive logic and belief in authorities. And one has to understand that Aristotle set him up on a philosopher. Philosophy, it's like the self-help books in airports. They tend to quote other 7 deadly habits of such and such. Aristotle was just really selling his own work. Bacon does not expect any approach based on tradition to start with direct investigation of nature and then ascend to empirical and generical general knowledge. This criticism extended to Renaissance alchemy, magic and astrology. Because the methods of these disciplines are based on occasional insights but do not command strategies to reproduce the natural effects under investigation. Which is a whole thing of science. But if you want to criticize it, majority of what we are sold is that special something that another company can't produce because our company's magic. So we have a modern sort of alchemy. Perhaps the iPhone is a modern magic. You know, it's developing, it's, you know, Apple, the biggest company on earth, is involved in selling a certain look and the feel of magic, yet it's still silicon, it's still things like that. So an alchemy is completely whack, and then even Newton is a bit disappointing over his love of alchemy. His criticism is also concerned at contemporary technical literature, insofar as it lacks a new view of nature in an innovative methodological program. Bacon takes to task the ancients, the scholastics, and also the moderns. He not only criticizes Plato, Aristotle, and Galen. So Galen is the medical guy, and Galen, according to Galen, so many things, so many people died. He was the most, probably the most lethal of them all. So many people followed Galen, killed everyone, and also charged them for killing them, for these failings. But also Jean Fennel, Parisius, and Tilso, while praising the Greeks, Atomus, and Roger Bacon. Who's Roger Bacon? Who's Roger Bacon? I have to find out who Roger is. Probably his, couldn't be his dad. Who is Roger Bacon? I've never heard of Roger Bacon before. Bacon's manuscripts already mention the doctrine of idols as a necessary condition for constituting scientific a priva. And look, I must admit, we should teach the idol stuff. It's something that kids can relate to. It gives a mechanism for critique of bad science. You know, it's hard to say. We say that, you know, kids, you're bad. You're subscribing to bad. You're bad scientists. But the idols is a fantastic thing. I just love it. We go into the idols later on. In cogna et visa, et means and, he compares deductive logic as used by the scholastic to a spider's web, which is drawn out of its own entrails, whereas a bee is introduced as an image of a science operative. Whoa! What? Oh, why don't we have this in science? Why don't we have it? And this is the entire thing, because the education department is based on scholasticism are just amazing. But what a great, like a bee, the empiricist, by means of his inductive method, collects the natural matter or products and then works them up into a knowledge in order they produce honey, which is useful for healthy nutrition. Whoa! What a fantastic view. Which is the thing. In Bacon's follow-up paper, Regarditu Philosophiarum, he carries on his empiricist project by referring to the doctrine of twofold truth. What twofold truth is. De principis acqui originibus, he rejects the alchemist theories concerning the transformation of substances in favor of Greek's atomism. But in the same text, he sharply criticizes his contemporary Telesco for propagating a non-expandable halfway house to empiricism. Though Telesco proves to be a moderate modern, he clings to the Aristotelian framework by continuing to believe in quintessential, and the doctrine of the two worlds, which presupposes modes of natural worlds, one of sublunary and the other of superlunary spheres. Oh, okay, so this is pretty advanced. So Aristotle, in order to get his works, people said, you know, Aristotle, how does this rock here work? Oh, well, I roll it and it stops because it's bloody lazy, it's stupid. Okay, Aristotle, mate, see that up there? See, that's the moon. That doesn't fall, that doesn't stop, it keeps on going. And he says, no worries, mate. Puts his arm around you and says, there's two worlds. There's my world here where I rule, and of course, but above there, that's heaven. Ooh, heaven. And things never stop. Things are perfectly spherical. And it's interesting to see this in Renaissance art and so much stuff. And so this this is quintessential. And if I can say, this stupid logic, quintessentialism, this is quintessential, this is the fundamental reason that it works, this is why it works, quintessentially is, nowadays people say, instead of saying it's quintessential, they say it's in my DNA. It's in my DNA to provide service for you. It's in my DNA to attack all people. And sort of this all gets wrapped up with nationalism and all this type of stuff, which is unfortunate. Okay, section 3, natural philosophy, the theory of idols and the system of sciences. This is fantastic. So, Bacon, I now salute you. You have the spider's web and the spider and the bee, where the spiders are the bad guys. They're just dumb. And he now has the theory of idols. Now, the theory of idols, I may pause and do another one on it, because the idols, these are the most fantastic things, yet kids are not taught about Bacon at all in history or anything. And it's really asking me to go back and work out what a twofold truth is and stuff like that. And then here's this Renaissance guy, and he's got no view of what the rest of the world's going to come. He doesn't know about modern history. He's just poking around the place, and he says, you know what? That's crap. What's crap and what's not? What fact or crap? That's fact and that's crap. And he says, going through it, no, that's good. The atomists and stuff like that. So the atomists is basically the theory we worked out now. Yet, what we actually value in society is that extra special quiz. So we will buy aluminium from a preferred aluminium supplier who's got quality and service and a smile and a wink with it, and it's environmentally good. But it's still aluminium we're buying between the two things. That's an example. I'll try and actually talk about it a bit more. And to try and to give you a view of the ancient world, really, I just don't think people have understood the complexity of the ancient world, and they haven't really understood how Bacon's world is really different from anything that we could possibly imagine. And I haven't imagined it. It's taken me a while of reading back of it, and I'll go away, and next episode, hopefully I'll come up with to you, like, who the heck is Roger Bacon? Okay, thanks a lot for listening. Another podcast, another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.